This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Johnson, and today we shall turn our attention to the subject matter of last Thursday's hearing before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel which focused on Mamil Abu-Jamal. Mamil is an African-American journalist, political activist, former Black Panther Party member, and a current prisoner in a Pennsylvania state prison. In July 1982, Mamil was convicted of killing a white officer, Officer Daniel Faulkner, and Mamil was convicted by a predominantly white jury and sentenced to die. With us today is Mamil's attorney, Counsel Robert Bryan, who is part of the American Board of Criminal Lawyers, former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and who argued, along with others, last Thursday before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Thank you, counsel, for being here with us.
Well, it's a pleasure being here.
I understand that last Thursday the courthouse was jammed with spectators and demonstrators and protesters.
Yeah, it was rather unusual, particularly for a hearing before a U.S. Court of Appeals. I've been doing death penalty work for 30 years and have had many such arguments, but this one was quite different.
Quite different. You know, I did know that there were, you know, this case had caught the eye of international figures such as Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who talked about it, and Nelson Mandela, and even Salman Rushdie. Amnesty International has also been outspoken on this issue.
Absolutely.
I did know that Jesse Jackson had talked about it, but I didn't know that the National Black Police Association, that's Cornel West, Maya Angelou, Susan Sarandon, Martin Sheen, I mean, Oliver Stone has even talked about this, and they're following this case closely, so there's a lot of attention about this case.
And I will say that my friend Angela Davis has and continues to be very active in her support of Mamil Abu-Jamal. And I might point out in your intro, you mentioned he's in a Pennsylvania state prison. He's actually on death row in Pennsylvania, and he's been there for over 24 years in a cell that's probably smaller than most bathrooms in our homes.
Whoa. I saw that because I read that in Democracy Now!, the transcript, and I was absolutely amazed. I was absolutely amazed by a number of things, and if you would be so kind, I would like to discuss some of those things that you
absolutely
stated. Thank you very much. Well, before I do that, I want to say on the opposite side of this issue, there's, of course, many of the Philadelphia's Fraternal Order of Police and the Pennsylvania State Government and many, many pro-death penalty Republicans. I wanted to be as objective as I possibly can be.
There are a lot of people quite upset because, you know, obviously somebody died. That person was a police officer, and so there's a knee-jerk reaction by some people, or maybe a lot of people, that, well, whoever, you know, this is a terrible thing, and my client should be boiled in oil. But the truth in this case, as they say, is stranger than fiction. This is a case that's riddled with racism, fraud, police fraud, racism and misconduct by the prosecution. Essentially, everything that could go wrong in a death penalty case seems to, unfortunately for my client, to have transpired in the case of Mamil Abu-Jamal.
Could you tell us briefly, from Mamil's version of events, what occurred on December 9, 1981?
Well, Mamil, at that time, let's put it in context, already was a very well-known journalist. He not only did his journalism through predominantly African-American stations, but it was heard nationally on, for example, the National Public Radio, NPR network. I mean, he was, and his passion was injustice, corruption, you know, speaking out against those things. And he was known at that time as the voice of the voiceless. He was moonlighting as a taxi driver because sometimes, of course, you and I are both attorneys, but those in the field of journalism, it doesn't always pay as well as it should.
Yes.
And so he was moonlighting. He had a family, and he had absolutely no criminal record. He had been robbed once, so he was licensed to carry a pistol. Sometimes driving a taxi is not the safest profession. He happened to see across the street where he had, from his vantage point where he had stopped his taxi, a Volkswagen that had been stopped by a police car, and then he saw this big hulking white cop beating, if pardon my language, the hell out of a young black man who turned out to be my client's brother, and the man was beating him. The cop had about a 2 foot long metal flashlight and was whacking him. Mamiya ran in that direction to see what was happening, and at that point, things happened very quickly. There was another person at the scene there's some questions as exactly. We know the cop fired some shots. We know the cop shot my client in the chest. My client nearly died. We do know that the cop was shot twice and did die. Other cops arrived on the scene shortly thereafter, and they found Faulkner, the police officer, lying on the sidewalk dead. They saw my client slumped over there with this terrible bullet wound in his chest. And when the police realized it was Mamiya Abdul-Jamal, this man who had been outspoken against their abuses, the end justified the means. That became the philosophy. They picked him up, mortally wounded, and rammed him headfirst into a post, referring to him repeatedly with the N-word. They kicked him. It was a pretty nasty scene. And when he got to the hospital, he was thrown on the floor and kicked and referred to in not the most complimentary fashion. The case then was rushed to trial or rushed to judgment. He was represented by an attorney who did not want to be there and asked to be relieved from the case. And the jury really only saw only one side of the coin, if you will, as to what occurred. I mean, it was a tragic comedy of errors from beginning to end. And I will say this, Mr. Johnson, that the thread that's run through this case from those early morning hours of December 9, 1981, through last Thursday when we were in court, May 17, before the U.S. Court of Appeals, is racism.
You were talking about place this into context. One of the things the listeners need to know about Mamiya is that even at the young age of 14 years old, he joined a group of protesters who were protesting against the segregationist George Wallace. And while he was seeking the police in Philadelphia to assist him and the protesters from getting beat up by those who supported George Wallace, the police actually joined in and started beating Mamiya up at the age of 14, even at that time, and the protesters.
Well,
he's been an activist for a long time.
You know, Mr. Johnson, should I refer to you as Malik or Mr. Johnson? You sound so, you're so impressive. You have such a great courtroom voice that I want to call you Mr. Johnson. Anyway, Malik, something happened at that George Washington protest which listeners may find of interest. Mamiya got kicked by a cop in the head, not accidentally, deliberately. He went whoop into his head. And Mamiya later said, you know, what they did when they kicked me in the head, the best thing that ever happened to me, because that white cop, when he planted his foot in my head, kicked me into the, he said he kicked me into the Black Panther Party.
Yep. He sure did say that. He said it was the best thing that ever happened because he kicked him so hard, kicked him right into the Black Panther Party. And another thing about Mamiya is that before he could even vote, the FBI was doing surveillance on him.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it's a terrible thing. These terrible Black Panthers, they were doing things like running breakfast programs in poor neighborhoods. They were helping kids. You know, hey, the FBI's got to do this. They got to fight this crime, you know, of helping children and people, the needy, you know, and that's what they were doing. I remember a Black Panther case or type case I tried in Birmingham, Alabama, of all places. In the late 70s, early 80s, in which my client was doing that. They pinned a murder on him of killing a white police chief's son. We eventually got him totally cleared. But what happened with Mamiya, it didn't seem to matter what the evidence was. I mean, they targeted this terrible person, and Mamiya's done great things with his life, you know, being serious, and I think it's remarkable. Matter of fact, I was talking with a man in Philadelphia this afternoon named Reggie Shell, formerly very active in the Black Panther Party in Philadelphia, and he knew Mamiya when he was young. And, you know, Reggie has just wonderful memories about this young man who was so devoted to trying to help other people. Not, you know, he was all focused on others, not himself. And, you know, that attitude hasn't changed today, Malik.
Wow. You know, in Malik, Mamiya, I'm confusing myself with him. Oh, my goodness. This is how much I've followed his case. Mamiya is still helping people. Now, there's this, we know what happened, generally was somewhat of what happened December 9th, 1981. There here becomes this trial, June 1982. And we have a number of issues that you want, some of which you was the basis for your oral arguments before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals on last Thursday. Before we look at some of those issues, one in particular I want to speak about, I want to focus on this judge, the trial judge, during 1982, June and July. I believe his name is Sabo,
they pronounce it.
Sabo.
Albert,
okay.
Sabo.
Judge Albert Sabo, while presiding over Mamiya's case, the trial judge, Albert Sabo, was just outside the courtroom and referred to Mamiya by saying, and I'm going to use the language that he said, the presiding judge, said, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger," end quote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was heard by the court stenographer. And this
what happened, Malik, is that this court stenographer was with her judge, and they were going to another courtroom, and it was during a recess, and they passed Judge Sabo in this anteroom, and as people do, they stopped and exchanged pleasantries. And, of course, the pleasantries that came oozing out of Sabo's mouth like a poison was saying, quote, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger," unquote, referring to my client frying the electrocution and they being the prosecution. In other words, he was going to see that this man, for opposing the system, for having a certain color of skin, got his just desserts. I mean, I've been before some racist judges. One even once threw me in jail in the South for fighting his racist behavior, and I won the case before a white jury. I had an African-American client. So I won the case, but the judge ended up putting me in jail for contempt of court for 3 days. And it's like Mamiya getting kicked in the head. It was probably the best 3 days I've spent in my life. You know, he kind of kicked me in a nice direction. But I'd never been, my point is, Malik, I've been before some real bigots. But I've never been before one, and prosecutors, but we probably both have, but I've never been before one who was so arrogant or stupid or both to admit it. And this judge just, I mean, it was just, I think it says something about him, about the court system at that time in Philadelphia, that it was just business as usual, referring to defendants using the N-word, saying as a judge, you're going to help see that the person gets fried. You know, if it were written in a movie out of Hollywood, you know, I think we would say, oh, wait a minute, this can't happen. But in this case, it's not a movie script, Malik, it happened. It's incredible.
This is Hollywood script. This is not reality. When I read that, I was utterly shocked. That as far as this issue of judicial bias.
Well, let me tell you something, Malik. This court stenographer, her husband is a cop.
Oh, okay.
I mean, not a Philadelphia cop in another jurisdiction, but her husband's a cop. We're not talking about some left person way over the left like me, or you know, I mean, this is just a regular member of the system, a woman who worked in the court system, her husband was a cop, you know. So just thought I thought I'd add that.
Judge Sable also gave jury instructions that essentially required the jury to conclude that the jury had to sentence Mamiya to death unless they all agreed on one particular circumstance. What did the trial judge mean?
It's a little confusing just to throw. What he said was that the jurors had to be unanimous as to any particular special circumstance, which doesn't mean a lot even to lawyers unless you do this kind of type of work. But a death penalty case is two stages. It's the guilt, innocence. If a person's found guilty with a special circumstance, as in this case killing a cop, it goes to a second stage in which the jury must decide life or death. And in deciding whether life or death, the jury weighs aggravating factors, like if a person has a criminal record, which Mamiya did not, and mitigating factors. And what the judge was saying is, when, ladies and gentlemen, you get back to the jury room, and I'm paraphrasing, but what he was saying is, you have to be unanimous. In other words, let's say you and I are on the jury, and you say, Robert, I'm going to vote against death because Mamiya's done great things with his life. I'm going to say, I'm going to not vote for death because he's a really nice guy, you know, and he's a good journalist, and somebody else has another reason, he's got a family, whatever. Well, according to George Judge's instructions, if we don't all agree on the same one special circumstance, if we have different ones, then we can't vote life. We have to vote death. And that's not the law. The law says you can have 12 people give me 12 different reasons why the death penalty should not be imposed, and that's fine.
Where's the authority for this proposition in by the Supreme Court or anyone else? I have never heard this before.
Yeah, well, this is the Mills, a case called Mills, and that's what it says, is that type of instruction that happened in this case is fatally flawed from a constitutional viewpoint. It's just not fair. I mean, it stacks the cards against the person whose life is on the line, and that's not what it's about. A jurors can have any combination of reasons why a person should not be sentenced to death. Maybe in a case like Mamiya's, some jurors had what we refer to as lingering doubt. They convicted, they weren't really sure absolutely that he was a person who shot the cop. Well, that's another reason why not to give death. But according to this judge, all of them had to agree on that one point. Well, you know, you've got 12 people with 12 different points of view, and the U.S. Supreme Court says they don't all have to agree on the same point. I mean, that's
right.
Absurd. And I mean, and so, right. And what amazed me as a prosecutor, the deputy district attorney gets up there. Well, no, he was there in the audience, but a guy named Hugh Burns, who's a very good lawyer, but he got up there. He argued first because when a lower court reversed the death penalty, the state appealed, and that's why Mamiya's still on death row and he's still under death judgment, because that did not go into effect. And then we, our side, cross appealed on some other issues, which I assume we'll get to, but so the prosecutor at the argument on May 17, 2007, he's the first one to argue because they appealed first. And he started arguing this Mills issue, the death penalty issue. And I will tell you, Malik, these judges just were all over him, all three judges. The presiding judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals was in the center, you know, like God, and then he had two angels, one on each side, you know, the two other judges. And they were saying, well, Mr. Burns, this is contrary to the U.S. Constitution. How can you rationalize that? How can you explain that? This is contrary to a U.S. Supreme Court decision. This is contrary to our decisions. And he was in, but he's a smart lawyer, so he was giving all these reasons like we lawyers do, trying to twist things around. But so it's a very powerful issue. So I feel very good about that one, just based upon the questions.
Excellent. The attorney McGill at the time, he had exercised peremptory challenges, at least African Americans, potential jurors. I was curious, how many challenges did he give of cause or of just peremptory?
I don't remember the exact number of cause, and for our listeners who aren't legal beagles like us, if a person being removed for cause just means that they're not qualified. And they may not be qualified for reasons, for example, they may know somebody on one side or the other. They may say, I can't be fair in a case like this. They may, sometimes they're excused because they said, look, I'll lose my job. I mean, or I've got a doctor's appointment, or I've got surgery coming up.
They have a bias.
I have a bias. And one way or the other. So that's for cause. The other type of challenge is called peremptory challenges. And peremptory challenges, traditionally, lawyers, we on either side, can remove people for whatever reason. You know, and
we just don't
and,
like it.
Pardon? Yeah, you know, I look at somebody and say, well, I don't like the way this person's looking at me, or I don't like the way they're looking at my client.
Right.
But the Supreme Court said in a case in 86, Mills versus Batson, the Batson
right.
case,
yeah.
that if the even though peremptory challenges can be freely given, removing prospective jury members, it can't be race based. In other words,
right.
you can't sit there as a prosecutor and stack the deck against a person's African American. Or Asian American, what have you? You can't stack the deck against the person on trial, and so they developed a three prong process. The first prong being, is there a prima facie case of racism in jury selection? In other words, does it appear more likely that race was a factor? Then, if that's established, the second prong will be to give the prosecutor an opportunity to give race-neutral reasons. In other words, the prosecutor could, he or she could say, well, I removed Ms. Smith not because she was African-American, but because she was scowling at me or you know, just, I mean, some
right.
it has to be some reason. And then the third step would be, after the prosecutor gives these supposed race-neutral reasons, is whether or not they make sense, whether or not the prosecutor's lying, or whether or not they're reasonable. And so the stage we're at on this issue, and there are two more issues in addition to this, but where we are on this issue, it's the first step, prima facie. Is there enough there to cause a well-founded suspicion, that racism discrimination might have been at work. And what we showed, and what I argued, and also an attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, whom I asked to come in a couple of years ago to the case to do a friend of the court brief. Pardon?
Christine Swarns?
Yeah, Christina Swarns, who's a
yes.
very good attorney, gave a terrific
uh-huh.
argument. And unfortunately, she was limited to less time than I because normally they're not even allowed to argue. They just submit briefs, what we call amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs. But I filed a motion asking that she be allowed to argue. And
it was granted.
Absolutely. It was great. It was great.
Yes.
And we also were able to persuade the court to give us over double the time that we would normally have to argue. Of course, it applied to both sides.
You got
yes.
an extension of time?
Yeah, we had asked. The rule said 30 minutes per side. That was the order we got. And I filed a motion for double that. And the other lawyers in the case were saying, oh, they'll never grant that. Just ask for another 15. I said, no, I'm going to ask for double. Let's ask for another 30. And they granted it. So we got double the time. And then 4 days before the hearing, well, Saturday night a week ago, I filed it like at midnight. I electronically filed with the court a motion asking, because the way it was set up with cross appeals, I did not get the last word. So I filed a motion asking if I could have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and the court granted it. So we ended up with 65 rather than 30 minutes, which was nice. But anyway,
yes.
back to the racism and jury selection. So what we had in this case was that this prosecutor, this white prosecutor, used 10 of 15 strikes to remove people of color, African Americans.
Use 11.
No, it was 10.
Okay.
There's some slight dispute about the numbers. We had
yeah.
10
okay.
of 14, and there's 11 floating around, and 15. And we even got into that a little bit at the hearing, and I said, look, our statistics were 71% of African Americans struck. I said, let's just make it 2/3. Let's make it 66 2/3%. Let's just make it that. That's a pretty strong, powerful, and they only use 20 to 25% to remove white people. So that's pretty imbalanced. I mean, that's not balance, it's imbalance. I mean, it's very tilted towards discrimination. And
I'm a facey.
I would think so, but, you know, the judges got kind of confused on that, and they were saying, well, maybe not. And they said, what if the entire panel were 66% African-American? I said, what they weren't. You know, they do well. They have probably 15% on the panel that from which people were struck. So they seem to get a little lost on that, but I think they'll get reeled in, hopefully, with our briefing, which is very extensive. But the courts also say that they should look at other factors in addition to statistics. And the statistics are powerful in this case. But also they should look at things like this was an African-American defendant and a white person killed. This was also an African-American person and a white cop who was killed. This was a person who had been active in the Black Panther Party, was a supporter of Move's Right to Be Different. This was a case tried in an atmosphere of great hostility, the courtroom being packed with cops with toting their guns and, you know, so forth. I mean, the court should look at all of that. And at one point, one of the judges asked me, he said, well, Mr. Bryan, did the prosecutor say anything discriminatory? And bear in mind, two of the three judges we were arguing before were appointed by Ronald Reagan. So
Reagan, conservatives.
Yeah. But they didn't think, but I will tell you, they did not sound like it. They were asking provocative questions. They were jumping all over the prosecutor. And, you know, they're appointed for life. So I think, you know, I didn't. We'll see. The proof's in the pudding, how they decide. But they seem to be, I mean, very fair. They knew the issues. They were on top of the case. And they were asking questions, just peppering us with questions from beginning to end. But they asked me at one point, well, did the prosecutor say anything discriminatory? And I said, well, of course not. This is a good lawyer. Idiots are not selected out of the district attorney's office to try capital murder cases. They pick their best lawyers. And this guy certainly had better sense than to say something stupid like that. So the only person I've ever known of who's stupid enough to admit their racism was the trial judge during the recess. You know, most people don't do that, even if they're that way. So I think what's interesting, Malik, is that this is about Mamie Abu-Jamal on trial, having been tried for killing a cop, but we spent all of May 17 in this court hearing talking about not him, but the racism of the prosecutor. They were on trial last Thursday, which is where it should have been.
And you were talking about the Mills case, but you know there are many cases, landmark cases dealing with racial discrimination, jury selection. You know, they say it's violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So I really you have good arguments.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, well, I know I'm right.
I hope you're right about these. I hope the judges read and know what you know, which we presented to them. I mean, why weren't you our judge?
Where were you,
Malik? We needed you last Thursday.
Well, the problem is I'm biased. See, I'm already in favor of your position and the death penalty, what you take on it. So, you see, I would have to recuse myself. Speaking of which, apparently the governor of Pennsylvania, who has sworn that if Mumia's death sentence is reinstated, that he, the governor, he pledges to sign a third warrant for Mumia's execution. It appears that the governor of Pennsylvania, he has a thirst for Mumia's death, I don't know. But apparently this governor was a district attorney during Mumia's case, but he wasn't actually the one who did it.
Right.
And this is something interesting. In March of this year, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office attempted to have the entire Third Court Circuit of Appeals recused from hearing this case. The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, their basis was that the existing Pennsylvania Governor, Ed Randall, was the then district attorney during the time of Mamie's trial. And this governor's wife sits on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. But she has repeatedly recused herself during this. What was the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office up to, as you call, with this red herring?
Well, that's what I put in my motion in response to them, that this was totally a red herring. What they were trying to do is remove the entire court, which is just below the U.S. Supreme Court, because this court has a track record of giving favorable decisions in on this issue, this exact issue, where there's racism in jury selection, of sending these cases back to the lower court. They went, and this court, I'm not sure whether this court, the Third Circuit, or out here in on the West Coast, the Ninth Circuit, which is based in San Francisco, where I am, I'm not sure which has the best record, but it'd be one of the two. And what they were trying to do is maneuver this case so it would be heard by judges like from Virginia, which has a terribly unfair group of judges, and also they said something in their motion. I mean, they were really stretching it. I mean, it was so bad. They said that this Judge Rendell, she's on the U.S. Court of Appeals, and as you say, always removes herself from any case out of Philadelphia. You know, nobody even has to ever ask her to do it. That they said that she and her husband, the governor, would sit around at night and talk about this case, and therefore she would be biased. And I responded that was very transparent and really just wasn't genuine. I thought they were just lying in their motion. I said, can you imagine? I would assume that this federal judge has more to do in the evening than sit around discussing people with personalities and their cases of people before her court. I mean, that's just absurd. So anyway, the U.S. Court of Appeals granted our request not to remove themselves, and so we went forward. And also, I also said in my response, not only were they trying to maneuver it before a different court, but they were trying to buy time. They wanted to delay this case, and I said, my client's been imprisoned over a quarter of a century. He's been on death row continuously over 24, and it's about time he has his day in court.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. About time. You know, there's so many issues here involved. I wanted to talk to you, and I probably won't have time. This is such a huge case.
Well, I'm enjoying this. I was grumbling it before we went on the air about the time, but, you know, we're on a roll now. Go for it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the four eyewitnesses really quickly during the Mamiya's trial. And I know about these. Are you there?
Well, what you had, and I don't want to get too much into the facts because I'm trying to get a new trial, and so
right.
I'm kind of trying to stay away from that and keep my arrows in my quiver. I mean, we've got a lot of new things, and I just want to say them. But let me just say this: that there was a woman at the scene, Cynthia White, supposedly at the scene, who supposedly saw the shooting and claims my client did it. We uncovered evidence, the defense uncovered evidence, and in fact she had been told, she had a long record, was always in jail. The police said, look, we'll cut you slack, we'll let you out.
She's a prostitute, isn't she?
Right. We'll cut you slack if you help us. We need you to testify that you saw, we need you to say you saw Mamiya Boutimal shoot this cop. And she agreed to do it. So she became the star witness. But she admitted to some other people that, in fact, she lied, that she did not show up at the scene of the shooting until after the shots were fired. I mean, she was nearby. But she did not actually see what happened. But she said what the cops wanted her to say. And that's how that evolved, which is, I think, rather interesting. Go ahead.
And that also goes to William Singletary. He was the fifth eyewitness was William Singletary, who said that Mamiya was not the shooter. And in the testimony on August,
Go ahead. There was a guy named Kenneth Freeman who was a passenger in the Volkswagen with my client's brother that had been stopped by this cop who was beating my client's brother with this flashlight. And there's evidence that Freeman fled the scene, and that Freeman may have been the actual shooter, which is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We get a new trial, all will be unveiled, but I think that's very interesting. And mm-hmm. I remember interviewing by telephone Singletary a year or two ago, and he lives, I think, down in North Carolina now, and he's just really a nice guy. And you know, just like you, when you handle enough cases and so forth, you develop just a feeling that when people are credible or not. And I just felt real good talking to him. He seemed very genuine. Incidentally, yeah. I think it's his brother who's the famous Singletary football player.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Well,
you know who he is?
William Singletary said that the police, the Philadelphia police, tore up his written statement, and that they had forced him to sign a different statement that the Philadelphia police dictated.
Yep, yep. Now, it reminds me, I mean, this case has shades. I don't know if you know, but I reopened the crime of the century, the Lindbergh kidnapping case. I wasn't around when it happened in the 30s, but I represented Bruno Richard Hauptmann, the man who was executed in New Jersey's widow many decades later, and I uncovered a wealth of evidence of people being told by the New Jersey State Police and the FBI they'd be brought in, and one guy was told, now look, we're all depending on you, Joe, to identify this man. And then Joe said, well, I've never seen him, I know nothing about it. No, Joe, it's your patriotic duty. And so that was back in the 30s. And it's interesting that my Anna Hauptmann, Mr. Hauptmann's widow in the Lindbergh kidnapping case, she's deceased now, but she actually lived in the Philadelphia area. And so so here we come full circle back to the case of Mamie Abu-Jamal, and the police were doing in the 80s what law enforcement was doing in the 30s and the Lindbergh Hauptmann trial of the century, telling people, scripting people what to say. And there's no question that regardless of what it comes down as to what had happened, the police were, I mean, there was a woman in a hospital, a security guard, a wannabe cop. Priscilla, when she's at the hospital, I mean, Mamie's at the hospital about to die, and she says, long time later says, oh, you know what, I remember, he said he's glad he killed the cop or something like that. In other words, he made an admission. You know, the doctors at the hospital, and I remember one interview with a very prominent surgeon there, he said this man wasn't able to say anything. He was groaning. He was dying, at that point.
He was unconscious, wasn't he?
Yes. And so, she has admitted, even though I'm sure she'll deny it now, but at one point she admitted that the police told her, said, look, we're all brothers, sisters of blue, we're all in this together, and we need you, Priscilla Durham, to say this. And she said, oh, sure, I'll help you. So it goes. So it's just, if all Mamie has ever asked for, all I ever asked for, whether it be from the courts or from you who are doing things like this interview, is just be fair with us. We're not even asking you to take a side, but be fair. But this case wasn't handled fairly, Malik. It was handled very unfairly. People were, scripted to say things that weren't true. Evidence suppressed. I've got a good one for you, because early, even though I'm in San Francisco, the early part of my career, I tried a lot of capital cases in the southeast of the U.S. And I thought I had seen some things until I saw this case in Philadelphia with Mamie. But it's a basic thing that I think you don't have to be a lawyer. If anybody watches television or reads a newspaper, understands that if there's been a shooting, it can be in Tupelo, Mississippi, or Yazoo, Mississippi, or Birmingham, Alabama. If, cops know that if there's been a shooting, there are certain basic things that are done at the scene. If there are weapons, there's some basic tests to determine whether or not somebody's fired a pistol. They can do that with their hands. There are basic tests that can be done, like fingerprints. And recently, some photographs surfaced that were taken by a freelance photographer, and there's a picture of one of these big Philadelphia cops standing there at the scene, holding both the cop's pistol and Mamie's barehanded in one hand. I mean, they weren't even concerned. They had made up their mind. The end justifies the means. This is the famous Mamie Abu-Jamal, who the crusading reporter who criticizes us. So he did it. So they didn't even bother to take fingerprints off the pistols.
And also, they didn't do any residue on his hand. And the ballistics expert is kind of, it's a .44. No, it's a .38. We're sure it's a .38. What about this Gary Wachshel? He's another kind of Priscilla, isn't he? Gary Wachshel, he was with the Mamie during all this time. During the medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Gary says, that Mumia made no comment during his official report. Then 3 months later, Gary suddenly, I remember. Mumia did confess. Yep, that's right. Well, you know, the Judge Szabo never allowed the jury to hear Gary Wachsel's original report. And I'm amazed.
Well, he was with Mumia. He was to guard the prisoner in the hospital who was the unconscious prisoner. And he specifically, he just did not fail to note in his report. What he said was the prisoner never said anything. Then 3 weeks later, with the cops running around saying, you know, we got to build a case against this journalist, this radical left-wing journalist, and they got him to say, oh, you know, I forgot to put in my report that he did say he did it. Now, if you don't have to be a cop to know that that's the most important thing. If you have somebody confessing, what's the first thing you're going to put in your report, that the prisoner said he did it?
I know. That was the first thing you put in. You know, another thing that struck me as strange about that trial, it was Namir's attorney, who was a court-appointed, because I know the Szabo didn't want Namir to do it, defend himself, to represent himself. But the attorney at that particular time never asked Mumia what happened December 9th, 1981.
The attorney really did some good things and some things that weren't good. The good thing he did was, before the trial, he objected, and he told the judge, he said, you know, this district attorney's office has a, and I brought this out to the judges last week in my argument on the 17th, he said, the district attorney's office, in every case, every murder case, systematically removes African Americans because they're black and for no other reason. And he said, I do not want that happening in this case. I want a questionnaire. And, you know, he wanted some protections. And the judge said, well, we're not going to do that. We'd never do that type of thing. And he said, well, the man's on trial for his life. But he that was a very good thing. But when he got into the trial, he wasn't prepared. The court wasn't giving him money to investigate or hire experts. So there, none of that was done. And so Mamiya's upset, naturally, because he said, look, I mean, shouldn't we be investigating? And shouldn't you be doing some of this? And so so this attorney then tells the judge, said, in front of Mamiya, he said, Judge, would you let me out of this case? I don't want to be here. And the judge said, nope, you have to be here. Then Mumia says, well, I want to represent myself, logically, because, you know, he could do as good a job, if not better, than somebody who doesn't want to be there and who is not investigating the case or bringing in experts. And, of course, there's a case, the name of it is Ferretta, in which one has a right to represent himself or herself, and the judge denied that. And Mumia would stand up and say, Your Honor, in his very calm but impressive voice, I have a right to represent myself. And the judge would say, Mr. Bujamal, if you do not sit down, I'm going to have you removed. And Mamiya would say, Your Honor, you can threaten me, but I have constitutional rights. Bailiff, remove him. Take him out. And as a result, Mamiya was a substantial portion of the trial. He was not even present in the courtroom. He was not where he could hear what was happening. And I'll give you an example. I brought this out in the argument about this racism and jury selection.
I'm getting beat up.
Are you getting worn down by all of this?
No, I'm not. I'm loving it. In fact, you know, I'm just going on and on. We're both counsel, and we're just like, wow, this is good. You know, and people in the virtual auditorium, they're beating me up. We want to talk, too. Why don't you shut up? We want to
you have people available to ask questions?
Yes, there's people who are listening to the radio, and there are people in a virtual auditorium. Everybody's hearing you. They're beating you up. Now, see, the thing is, what they don't know is what I know, that I don't have to let them speak at all.
No, I mean, I'd welcome questions.
But we're going to go ahead and go to break. And I hate to interrupt you, but they are going to beat, they're going to kill me if I don't allow them to speak.
Please, let them do it. I did not know, and I apologize.
It is the people speak. Radio, we're going to go ahead and take a break, friends, and once we come back, you will ask our beloved attorney here questions. Ask anything that you like. I think we are now at break. Seth, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. good. You know what, Rob? I want to tell you.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon
and his
power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Speak, we are speaking with Counsel Robert Brine, attorney from the Mumia Abdul-Jamal. You all know the counsel, Brian, is a part of the American Board of Criminal Lawyers, the former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and he also argued along with others last Thursday before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. We're going to go ahead and take some questions from the virtual auditorium, and also you may call in the phone number. I'm pretty sure that some of you will be posting it, but we're going to take the first person right now. This individual is one of the... She spoke to me about this case, Robert, and she absolutely adores your work. And she's so very much invested in this issue. And her name is Elle. She's from Oregon. Elle, come up to the mic, please. Ask your question of Mr. Brian.
Thank you. I am so grateful for you being here, and it's an honor to talk to you. I've been a supporter of Mumia's case ever since I heard about it. I wanted to ask you something. I read a few months ago that the city of Philadelphia sued Paris, the city of Paris and the city of Saint-Denis, for honoring Mumia and for naming a street after him. You know, Europeans are very much against the death penalty and are appalled at this travesty of justice. And I wanted to know from you, you know, what is the Mumia camp thinking about this? I know you have a lot of support from France, but my question to you is anything coming out of this, or are they just blowing hot air? Because I don't think the people in Paris are really impressed or really care.
Is it Dale? Is your name Dale?
L.
Okay, Gail, okay. Support in Europe is phenomenal. My wife, incidentally, is French, and the family home is there, so we're there a lot anyway. But in various countries in Europe, but I was asked first about France. France in 2003, October 2003, actually had a ceremony in the city hall. French is called the Hotel de Ville, and the mayor of Paris awarded an honorary citizenship to Mumia Abdul-Jamal, which was stunning. We're not talking about some little town in France. We're talking about Paris, the city of lights. And Mumia was the first person honored with an honorary citizenship since Pablo Casal, the great painter. Picasso, the great painter. And Angela Davis, I got Angela Davis to come and officially accept it, since she's such a great leader in the struggle for human rights. And a number of cities have actually recognized Mumia, both in France and Italy and various countries. Saint-Denis, which is, they don't like to consider themselves a suburb, but they're just north of Paris. It seems like a suburb. It's where the big sports stadium is. Actually, last year, renamed a street, Rue Mumia Abdul-Jamal, street after Mumia. And that caused a big uproar, particularly in Philadelphia. And some politicians, right-wing politicians, got a hold of it and demanded that the French revoke the name of the street how dare them, and how un-American, and also to remove his honorary citizenship. And I got a touching letter from the mayor's office in Paris, and they just said that the these right-wing politicians in America can go play in the traffic. I mean, they were not about to. They stand for human rights. They have a history of it, and the human rights abuses in this case, as Malik Johnson and I have been discussing, are horrendous. And that Mamiya has been honored with street naming and citizenship because he has become an international symbol in the fight against the death penalty and human rights abuses. So, and I might add that in England, the most prominent barristers in London this past summer sent a letter to the court and officially recognized the human rights abuses in this case, and demanded a new trial. Journalists have done the same thing. So the support from across the pond, across the Atlantic, has, and of course Amnesty International, which is headquartered in London, has even done a special report on this case, demanding that the death penalty be reversed and that my client be granted a new trial.
I'd like to add really quickly before the next speaker, Robert, you know the Republican Party of the 59th Ward, covering basically approximately Germantown, Philadelphia, they filed legal charges against France.
Oh, the whole thing with the bars, too, they had this idiot, I'm sorry, this lawyer in Paris, who's not even a member of the French bar, he's actually an American, he's living there, and he made all this fuss about he was going to file suit and all of this, and you know, it was all theater on their part, and that they were going to send a delegation over in this past November, and there was no delegation that arrived. It was all just a lot of hot air. I mean, it was like their protest was a mile wide, but about a tenth of an inch deep. There was nothing to it. It was like cotton candy. It just kind of dissolved when you try to bite into it. And I mean, these people are not of consequence. They were just trying to gain some headlines and some publicity, and it backfired on them because the French and the international community, European community, were outraged, Malik, that any people from another country would demand that another country should do this or that, and it was just the arrogance that that's perceived of some Americans in Europe, that it's the Bush-type arrogance of demanding that Europeans do our bidding. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We have a history of fighting for human rights of people, and we've abolished the death penalty, and you people want us to roll back history, turn time back? No way.
You know what? Can I ask you a
favor? The courage in standing up to this current administration and all of, you know, I think it's great that they took this stand. The Europeans, I'm saying.
Hey, Rob, can I ask you a favor, please? Please, please. Could you stay just 15 more minutes? Because if I don't get these callers in,
they're going to kill me. You've hooked me. I, as I said, I was younger a little bit at the beginning, but I think this is great, so let's do it.
Because they want their 30 minutes of asking questions, and I'm going to give it to them, or they're going to hang me. The next caller, a next person in the virtual auditorium, his name is Richie. He's from Maryland. Richie, come up to the mic. Ask your question of Council Brian, please.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the waterfall, by the relief of the grass, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is my land, from California to New York and Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.